So prison privatization, how far underway is it? Are there more privatized prisons than public prisons? Where are we at with privatization right now?
Somewhere between 10 and 15% of prisons nationally are private. Now, that doesn't include immigrant detention facilities. It doesn't include treatment facilities. But in terms of municipal jails, state and federal prisons, about 10 to 15%. And it doesn't sound like that much, but if you know that there's 2 million people in prison, that's about 30,000 people.
Okay, so what are the purported benefits of privatized prisons?
What do they say are the benefits?
Yeah.
Well, they say the benefits are basically better services for cheaper, right? I mean, that's always the way, the rhetoric of privatization, which is all about eliminating bureaucracy and red tape and and that by getting through, not having these bureaucratic hoops and everything to go through, you can cut out costs and ultimately save taxpayers money and then actually give, you know, better delivery of services. That's how they call it.
And so what are some of the problems with privatized prisons?
Well, there's problems on many levels. There's the initial ones that people should be concerned about are practical problems, so the conditions of confinement for those who are already locked up, which generally have something to do with cost saving. The way privatization works in other industries is that the private company, whoever, would come in and be able to cut out all the fat out of the budget. Right? And in prisons, there is no fat. There's never been any fat. There's nothing but the bare essentials, and a lot of times not even that, right, in prisons. So when a private company comes in, the only way for them to actually try to make any money is by cutting costs, and that means basically what are essential services, cutting down food, cutting down medical care, cutting down the types of things that would make the environment more safe than less safe and more tolerable, more humane. So you've got cases of brutality on through to cases of HIV-positive prisoners who don't get any medication. Now, that's the practical level. And, of course, one thing that I'll say with all of these things, you know, especially on the practical level, these are also problems that are in public prisons. Public prisons are not, are just as bad. The other reasons that private prisons are a problem, I mean, there's economic things. They don't save money. They actually do the opposite. On paper, sometimes it looks like they save a little bit of money here and there. Studies say that they'll save a little bit. Sometimes studies will say they don't save any. But there are also a lot of hidden costs, which have to do with sometimes with litigation. If there's litigation against a prison, that can come back to the state. Once that money goes into private hands, it's taxpayers' money. Once that money goes into private hands, it no longer stays in the public sector, meaning once it goes in and pays for prison services, then it would bounce through and maybe pay another public agency to do laundry services. It would pay the public agency that would come in and bring food.
Oh my God,
dear. This money, what it does is it just goes into the private hands and that's it, and we never see that again. It's no longer in the public. It's now private. The other problems are that it's just like totally corrupt. It's a totally corrupt industry. It's a totally insider industry. It's one of the highest subsidized industries in the country, which is corporate welfare. And ultimately what it does is it creates incentives. It's the most obvious example. That's one of the reasons to talk about privatization first and then move on to public prisons.
Is that
privatization, because of the profit motive and that being the driving force. In capitalism, once someone or something is commodified and reduced to its economic value, then all the decisions of value in terms of how they're treated and where they go and who can see them, everything is based on economic equations as opposed to moral standards or something like that. So privatization helps to bring into the system and institutionalize incentives to incarcerate more, right? There was an early study that was done by Prudential Securities, you know, in Wall Street, about private prisons and whether or not this was a viable investment arena for stockholders. And what they pointed out, there are four major dangers for the private industry. One was falling crime. Falling crime would be a threat to the industry. alternatives to incarceration would be the third is the ending of mandatory minimum sentencing laws, and then scaling back in the war of drugs. And this is actually someone quotes this in my film Corrections and says at the end of that it seems to me that these are all things that we need right now, and these are all things that are a threat to the industry. So here you have a politically powerful political lobby and constituency that has a much closer reach to lawmakers and legislators than you or I do, mm-hmm. Or most of the people in this conference do, or most people in the country do, who then can say, hey, this is bad for our business. Don't pass this. Don't reconsider overturning the drug laws. We need tougher laws. We need laws. And it's not for safety. It's not for justice. It's for profit. So those are the basic
prioritization. And you had mentioned earlier how after September 11th, people from the industry consulted with Wall Street investors saying how... Can you describe what they were saying after September 11th?
Well, I have a friend who corporations have quarterly conference calls where they meet with a stock analyst. They discuss, they sort of make projections for the upcoming quarter, mm-hmm. In terms of what it's going to hold for the company and are they a good investment or not. Then the stock analyst analyzes that and goes back out to the Wall Street and tells them what they figure. And this is something that also is totally corrupt. I mean, you know, we're in the age of Enron right now where one of the problems, I think, with the way the Enron stuff has been treated so far is that even though people are looking elsewhere to see where are there other Enrons and stuff like that, is that Enron is not the exception. All these kinds of ways in which these sort of Enron has gotten themselves into trouble, mm-hmm. is the same thing that goes throughout, you know, throughout industries and that are publicly traded, especially private prisons. One of those problems outside of like hiding debts and hiding liabilities and all these things that would make their stock seem less valuable and trying to pump up their stock prices, right? Mm-hmm. One of the things that also happens is that the stock analysts who meet with the company and evaluate the company and then turn back around to Wall Street and say, I rate this company this way, I rate this company this way, those people sell the same stocks oftentimes that they evaluate. Mm-hmm. And so there's a total conflict of interest, a really, really direct conflict of interest that somehow people don't seem to think that's a big problem. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the things, so this is the context of this conference call. Mm-hmm. A friend of mine transcribes them because they have to be available to the public and on the web. Mm-hmm. You can get them listening on RealPlayer and stuff.
Yeah.
Both Wackenhut and Cornell companies have been quoted as talking about... the prospects.
These are the prison. This is prison industry companies.
These are private prison companies, uh-huh. Two of the biggest, and both of them have talked about the biggest prospects for our industry will be if we get to build internment camps. And Wackenhut was even quoted saying, he doesn't say internment camps, but the stock analyst says, "What about internment camps?" And George Zoli turns around and says, "Well, you know, so and so, that's how we got our start, was with immigrant detention, and et cetera." So. The context is that state business has been falling because on the state level, crime has been dropping, mm-hmm. and alternatives have been starting. Crime has been dropping for a long time, but we're finally starting to acknowledge that crime is dropping is the difference now. Some people are, at least. And private prison companies have also had lots of troubles in terms of riots, in terms of lawsuits and everything, where the states aren't contracting with them enthusiastically. But the federal government now is contracting with them more. The INS and the Federal Bureau of Prisons are now the biggest boom for the private prison industry and are bailing them out.
And is the private prison industry growing pretty fast? Pretty profitable industry right now?
I don't know if I would say if it's profitable or not. I'd rather just stay away from that altogether. I know Harmon Ray, who is an anti-private prison activist in Nashville, bought one share of CCA's stock, mm-hmm. so he could go to shareholder meetings and mm-hmm. stuff like that. And he bought it somewhere around $30, and last I talked to him, it was down around a dollar or something that. Because the thing is that the industry almost bellied up a year and a half ago or a year ago, and that's when that's why these new federal contracts are called the federal bailout.
So what happened? I mean, why did they almost belly up?
Because they're not, I mean, first of all, it's not a profitable thing. You know, I mean, this, it's, it's the where it's worked, it's only worked because it's been subsidized so heavily, meaning that any profits are artificial in a sense. It's not based on material value. Mm-hmm. It's best based on speculative value, et cetera. And they've also been losing contracts. And ultimately, the industry is not sustainable unless, and this is just a basic capitalist truism, right, is that periods of profit are periods of growth. You don't, you know, like the private prison industry has to continue growing for it to be sustainable industry. Mm-hmm. If it levels off, it can't continue. Mm-hmm. And that's what's been happening. So they've been in total crisis. And so they were like, where else can we go? Where else can we get business? So they've been looking for business in third world countries who are being asked ever so politely by the U.S. globalization conglomerates to adapt tough-on-crime strategies and police and prison strategies to deal with their growing social contradictions and poverty and stuff like that. You know, if you want this kind, if you want us to forgive this debt, or if you want us to give you remove these sanctions, or if you want us to help subsidize, you know, or help you, give you a loan or something like that, then you have to end welfare. You have to take on these neoliberal policies and tough on crime, law and order stuff, prisons and police and everything is part and parcel of those neoliberal policies.
Hmm. Interesting. So when did privatization of prisons begin in the United States?
After the Civil War.
Oh, really?
Private prisons were plantations that lost their workforce. And so the Black Codes were passed as a way of getting to re-enslave freed blacks by making things that behaviors and acts that would be characteristic to blacks, like homelessness, mm-hmm. Owing white people money, things mm-hmm. like that, making those crimes where there hadn't been crimes already. This filled up the southern prison systems incredibly, and they would be leased out back to the plantations that they got freed from. So Angola, which is Louisiana state prison, mm-hmm. Parchman Farm, which is Mississippi's state prison, these were plantations before the Civil War, and they got converted into prison. They built walls around them after the Civil War. So those are the original private prisons, right, that were run for the profit of business owners and the state also. That's the thing about privatization, too, mm-hmm. is that it's about profit for individuals in this case, but there's also a larger sense in which it makes clear to us that the system that we're in is based upon a history of sort of bondage and forced labor. Criminalization is at times when that becomes impossible, criminalization is one of the ways of making sure that happens.
And you had mentioned something earlier about a different context today where we don't, when, you know, back in the 19th century where they criminalizing behavior so as to get blacks back onto the into the plantations.
Uh-huh.
You see in a different context today, of course.
Right.
But where it is an issue of surplus labor.
Right.
And how prisons could potentially be. Could you explain that a little bit more?
Sure. Well, I mean, surplus labor is basically people who are potentially part of the labor force that cannot get jobs, that are essentially surplus. They are more people than jobs. This is a kind of a crisis, This leads to sort of social crisis. It's an economic crisis for people locally. It has, you know, really bad effects on local communities and stuff because it's usually not spread out across different strata of society equally. It's very specific groups. Today, in the period of like deindustrialization, where factories have closed down the U.S. and moved down to Central and South America through NAFTA or other sort of trade agreements, taking them to Indonesia or wherever. Today we're not in a similar period where we need to convince masses of the working class to come work for factories. We're in the position of trying to help people who used to work in factories or used to own small farms who've been taken out by agribusiness or something like that. We're now in a situation where we're trying to help those people figure out what they can do without factories or without small farms, and the fact that they don't have jobs for those people anymore. And One of those reasons is because labor forces have been shrunk down to maximize profits. Mm-hmm. If you get Lockdown in America by Christian Parenti, he outlines really well how in the 60s there was a profit crisis where the golden age of capitalism in the U.S. was a period after World War II where we were able to keep our wartime economy going by helping the rest of the world rebuild itself and taking what was then the military industry and making it permanent and trying to find ways of how could they keep on building. Noam Chomsky writes about this really well in terms of how a lot of modern technology that came about was actually wartime technology that was then they figured out how can we keep building this stuff? It makes our economy good to keep building it. Yeah. How can we keep building it if there's no war? Well, we can bring it into the private sector and sell, you know, transistor radios. We can sell this. That whole boom after World War II died off in the 60s, and there was a profit crisis, meaning that the people at the top were not able to continue making as much profit as they had been. Also, part of that profit crisis was because the labor movement had been really successful. Wages were sort of at like an all-time high for working people. Unemployment rate is key to maintaining low labor costs in capitalism, right? Where you, the more unemployment that there is, the more likely someone is afraid to lose their job, and therefore the less likely they are to strike or advocate for better conditions. They're just happy to have a job, right? So that was a way of trying to regain profitability for the corporate class, and is increasingly. I mean, just since September 11th, the responses from Bush to Giuliani to corporations and everybody is to downsize. Grants that have been given to companies and stuff like that to help them deal with their losses have not had any sort of stipulation that do not lay people off. Mm-hmm. They've been massive layoffs. You know, mm-hmm. there's just unbelievable hundreds of thousands of people who have been laid off. So airline companies and, you know, everybody else can maintain the profits that they're used to. Mm-hmm. So that's the context that we're in, where large surplus populations are key to maintaining and continuing to increase the amount of money that gets funneled into the upper classes. Criminalization and imprisonment are two of the ways of dealing with those surplus populations.
Now, I imagine people hearing this might say, okay, there may indeed, in the 80s, we've had this deindustrialization process, this downsizing process where companies go abroad. So you have this increasing unemployment. And we've had increase in the prison population during the same time. Mm-hmm. But to suggest that the two are related is a whole nother thing.
Sure.
And how would you respond to someone who said, look, you're trying to suggest that someone in the government actually has sat down and said, okay, how can we reduce this labor surplus and come up with the prison system as a means by which to deal with?
Right. Well, I don't know that there's talk about it that directly. Mm-hmm. There certainly, I mean, you don't have to look hard at the speeches that people like Alan Greenspan give, or treasurers or other people given throughout history, that there's the term, and this is another thing that Christian Parenti talks a lot about, is it's just a policy that at certain times you discipline labor. When labor is starting to get too powerful, you discipline them. And the way you do that primarily is by threatening their job security. That's not a controversial statement at all. That's very well documented.
Yeah, yeah.
And is very common. Now the question is, now you don't have the same people necessarily turning around and saying, let's put all these people in prison. They don't have to say that. One of the other contexts that we have at the same time is another way to increase profitability is to decrease the liabilities for the corporate class in relation to what they contribute to social welfare, right? Because part of the New Deal, right, for example, which was what helped us get out of the Great Depression, was to develop insurance policies and effective insurance policies for the people at the top, which would make sure that there was at least a decent standard of living for working people, which would make them more productive. And so this is the invention of social welfare programs, a lot of public education kind of programs, public works projects that were like, you know, ways... federally subsidized ways to put people to work by building a bridge or by building a canal or by building parks or whatever, you know, mm-hmm. building roads. And this, by putting everybody to work and by helping maintain a standard of living and having social welfare programs, then that in effect is insurance to the upper class that they can maintain the kind of profits that they want through what they extract through the labor of others, mm-hmm. and not have to worry about, you know, effectively revolt or people, you know, calling bullshit on the system. At the same time as we've seen this labor surplus grow, we've seen the basic dismantling of the welfare system altogether. And not just welfare in terms of welfare checks, mm-hmm. but all of the public welfare institutions mm-hmm. that are basically the security nets for people who are not doing as well in the system for whatever reason, or people who are doing fine in the system and have just gotten laid off. There is no security nets for those people anymore. So of course you see an increase in crime. I mean, the types of crimes that we see wind up in prisons are just a few basic types of crime. They're either sort of like need-based crimes, right? They're pathological crimes, or they're crimes that are based off related to some sort of addiction. Mm-hmm. All of those things are things that can be treated, that are treated and taken care of in parts of society where there is not poverty and neglect. Those are the types of characteristics of, those are specific, especially to people whose communities are not able to, who are underdeveloped and are not able to be given the resources to do what they could possibly do if they had the right resources. And so the response, again, then eventually is to criminalize instead of, you know, socialize or help. And of course, I mean, this is so, it's actually really complex because you have to talk about the role of the media, you have to talk about the ending of affirmative action and how the fears of the middle class who've been losing their jobs, especially, and working people, how instead of their fears have been diverted away from paying attention to people at the top, and have been displaced onto welfare mothers and illegal immigrants who actually don't put a drain on the system at all. Illegal immigrants tend to contribute more to the system than they take away from the system. But dominant belief is that, like, this is your problem, you know? Your problem is crime. Your problem is not unemployment. Your problem is crime. It's like this sort of explanation, you know, system of explanations that help the system function well. I don't know. You can think that sounds like conspiracy theory. I don't think it's not too hard to look and see those histories and see how that's how it's really happened.
Mm-hmm. What percentage do you think of people in prison today are in there for either drug use or selling drugs?
It's a huge statistic. I mean, it's around 50%. It's even more if you consider people who commissioned other kinds of crimes under the influence of drugs. I think the immediate projection is that if we were to totally decriminalize drugs and give everybody who is convicted of some sort of drug-related offense treatment instead of prison time, that prison system would be reduced immediately by at least 50%. I mean, it's a staggering statistic.
And you think that would save money? Do you think the amount of money that we would
spend? Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it doesn't cost. It costs between, you know, $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 a year to house a prisoner. Closer to 20 if they're minimum security. Upward toward 80 to 100,000 a year if you're talking about prisoners on death row and stuff like that. It's incredibly expensive.
How much you say for the death row? How much does that cost?
It's between $70,000 and $100,000 a year because it's the highest, the higher secure level of security, the higher the costs are, and that's the highest level of security.
Wow.
And it varies from state to state. That's an astronomical amount of money. Mm-hmm. It's absurd how much, what could be done with that money outside of prisons. I mean, the fact is that there's not a single, and there's studies to back all this up, there's basically not a single type of behavior that lands, or social problem that lands people in prison that could not be treated more effectively, more humanely, and more cost-effectively outside of prison. Mm-hmm. But now getting back to privatization mm-hmm. and, you know, the growth of prison guard unions, who are incredibly powerful in a lot of states mm-hmm. and are even more powerful than the private prison lobby in terms of trying to put through three strikes laws and all these tough on crime laws because mm-hmm. their unions have been growing, et cetera. We have to think about the way in which all of the research-based studies, all of the really reasonable and smart and humane, effective types of strategies that people are developing, they're out there. Alternatives to incarceration, they're out there. The law and order people just have a total monopoly on that discourse. You know, they'll say, yo, what do you listen to those ivory tower academics for? What do they know?
Yeah.
You know, well, I'll tell you what, they did a study and they know more than you do because your job is to keep people in cages. And And, you know, prison guards would tell you right away, oh, we know prisoners better than anybody because we spend 24 hours a day with them. We spend 7 days a week. Nobody else sees prisoners as much as we do.
Yeah.
Well, that's, you know, you're not in a position, you're in a totally biased position. You're in a position that's not objective enough to have some sort of expertise as to who that really is because you're people locking them up. You can't be objective. So, I mean, one of the shifts we really need to see is people paying attention to the really smart discourses that people are looking for and not looking to the state to solve problems and not even looking to alternatives to incarceration as being just how do you treat people who once they've committed a crime. Mm-hmm. But think about what are the types of problems that already exist in the communities where people who commit crimes come from, mm-hmm. and deal with those on the front end before crimes ever get committed.
Yeah.
And it's not about intervention, like take them out and put them in a home or something like that, but it's about how can communities look like they do? How can you go to housing projects and say, how can people live like this in this country?
Yeah.
Anywhere in the world.
Yeah. Even though it's sort of impossible to do, it's like thinking of Bush's tax cut. Mm-hmm. How many more people are going to end up in prison because of that tax cut? I would imagine quite a number of people are going to end up in prison because of tax cut through various means, the reduction in programs that would keep people mm-hmm. kind of functioning.
Right. Yeah.
But so seeing the connect, I mean, I think there's a lot of work that could be done with bringing the connections in between those kind of policies and how they might.
What we really need to do, too, is we really need to do grassroots-based work that is anti-state work. And I don't mean, I mean, that necessarily that means that we're you know, trying to shut down the state or whatever, although it might be. But what it does mean is that we need to keep our people outside of the hands of the state. Because the people who are in the community are the only people who really know how effectively to help people. And they need to be given the resources to do that. And in order to be given the resources, they have to be seen as a constituency. Mm-hmm. They have to be understood as people who vote and people who are care about their own people and are going to do this work for their own people, whether they have the resources or not. People are going to come up with money to keep their kids out of jail if they can.
Yeah.
You know, and we need to really start building up from the grassroots. We can't look to people in the government to help out in some sort of liberal way with a capital L. We need really effective empowerment strategies in local communities. And that's who, and there's a lot of people in the prison, anti-prison movement now who are middle-class white kids and stuff like that that are not from the communities where prisoners come from. And are really anxious to find out what can I do to help this and how can I help fight it. And the best way is to try to collaborate with and have discourse, develop dialogues between your community and other communities to humanize and bring attention to what, you know, the tragedies that go on in those communities before someone commits a crime or whatever gets to that point. Mm-hmm. And that's the way you'll see prison. I mean, you know, you start doing that, you do that enough, and this is being optimistic, of course, maybe a bit idealistic, but if you do that enough and you get every community to the point where they are sustainable communities where they can provide for their own and keep their people out of the hands of the state, you'll see the prison system become obsolete. I mean, you know, maybe you'll just have, you know, prisons for people who skim money off the top corporate greed or something like that, but I don't even think prison isn't the best response to that.
Now, if there's final question would be, can you think of three things that come to mind, points about the prison system, public and private, that might not come to people's minds? Three points to consider that people might not consider when they think about the prison.
77% of the people in prison, of the 2 million people in prison, are there for nonviolent offenses. Mm-hmm. People are very afraid of think that everybody in prison are mass murderers and stuff, and they're not. Only 23% roughly are there for violent offenses.
Mm-hmm.
Even though African Americans make up barely 12% of the national population, mm-hmm. they make up 50% of our prison population nationally.
Mm-hmm.
In some places like Louisiana, they make up over 80%. Nationally, between 70 and 80% of all prisoners are people of color. And that is an overrepresentation of certain communities, what people call disproportionate. Let's see, and the third, final thing. I mean, one thing I would offer is that prisons don't make you safe. They don't make you, they don't provide justice, and they don't make you safe. Because explanation behind prisons is that it's a deprivation of liberty, right? That you're depriving someone of their inalienable rights to life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness, etc. But the people, for the majority, the over 90% of the people who go to prison do not come from communities who could be reasonably classified as having, enjoying traditional civil liberties and being civically included in the democratic process. They're already out. So the deprivation of liberty is actually a wholly inappropriate punishment on that level for those people. And I'll just say that.
Yeah. Well, awesome. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks a lot.